I sure hope you're hungry.
Ooh, I'm starving.
Wash those hands, pull up a chair, and secure that feed bag. Because it's time to listen to Scott Tolinsky and Wes Boss attempt to use human language to converse with and pick the brains of other developers. I thought there was going to be food. So buckle up and grab that O-shit handle, because this ride is going to get wild. This is the Syntax Supper Club.
Welcome to Syntax. On today's Syntax Supper Club, we're going to be talking with Steve Sewell about visual UI development. Steve is working on Builder.io, a little bit of a project we talked about a couple of episodes ago with Mishko. And we're going to be talking all about visual programming, visual languages, how something like this actually works behind the scenes, and maybe some of the challenges of working with these types of tools in terms of building them. My name is Scott Tolinsky. I'm a developer from Denver. With me, as always, as you know, is Wes Boss. Say hello, hey. Wes.
What's up, everybody?
There we go. And Steve, welcome to the show. We're so happy to have you. I can't wait to get into this thing. I'm a huge visual programming type of fan. So can you just give us a little bit of intro, who you are, what you're doing, what you're working on, and what is Builder?
Absolutely. I love that you're a visual programming nerd. This will be fun. So anyway, I'm Steve. I'm co-founder and CEO of Builder.io. Previously, what I do, I actually began my career on the design side. Always wondered why you can't design an application that works. You have to design it, and somebody else got to program it. And when I learned the programming side, I was self-taught. I was like, wait, you have to type background red, margin type top 10 pixels. Like, what the heck? This is insane. And learned, obviously, those challenges plus all the workflow challenges that ensue. It was wild to me. I did a couple startups. Most recently, did one that was acquired by a company called ShopStyle. They are like an e-commerce aggregator. So kind of like a Google Shopping. If Google Shopping sucked like 20% less, the space is hard. Google Shopping is like a pay-to-rank system. So I think you probably don't use it. Use Google Search, which is actually like quality ranking, you know, ordering as opposed to like pay more to order higher. So, you know, poor results. But anyway, working there, I realized quickly that I wanted to work on cool technology. E-commerce businesses or just selling anything online is much more marketing-driven than tech-driven. Mm-hmm. So it's you don't build cool features to sell more products. You market the products better. You show more personalized results. You show more interesting, you know, you run A-B tests to see what type of stuff should be on the homepage to get you to buy the stuff that Amazon does that everybody else wants to. And so in doing that, that's where we ran into this problem of headless CMSs, the way we were using, the way most people use them, it's a little hard to give marketing the ability to just do what they wanted, which is ideally to have an interface like, you know, Squarespace or Wix or Webflow, just drag and drop this product here and this hero there and a newsletter sign up today, 50%, you know, A-B test only to previous returning visitors who shopped men's products previously, you know, stuff like that. It frequently came down to the amount of stuff we had to build for them was a huge like engineering ticketing queue for like new landing pages for this new ad campaign and all these new tests and all this personalized variations, just trying to sell more product, right? And so ultimately, we kind of had this epiphany, like if they could just have a draggy droppy thing, but it was using our components. This was an Angular site. So if it's just our Angular components, they could just drag drop them in any order, run this as a test, run this as a variation towards, you know, this cohort of users, whatever, all our problems would be solved. And I won't spoil the rest, but that's what led us to build or led me to quit, start building Builder.io. And of course, we have a whole team today and solve that problem for all the frameworks, make it essentially a visual programming system on top of the framework stack you have today. Sorry if that was longer winded than you were looking for, but that's, I think, the full background.
No, I think that was perfectly winded. I think that was exactly what we need. Yeah. So, you know, you very briefly or quickly mentioned that you can bring your own components. And very like just looking, you know, number one thing that you have on your features is that this works with any tech stack. Mm. So like depending on whatever types of components you're writing, you know, Svelte, Vue, React, whatever, this works. How is that possible that you're able to combine all these things with a visual programming language?
Yes. Yeah. It's confusing at surface level, but it's simpler than you'd think. Somebody on Twitter, we talked about this on JS Jabber once, and somebody commented on Twitter that was the most confusing episode of that podcast ever. So I'm going to try and do a much better job at describing it this time. In short, it's pretty straightforward. So normally when you create like your homepage in Next.js, you hard code, you know, hero components at the top with this title and image, you provide the props. Below that, whatever else component, maybe a cool little quote components and here's the props. Well, imagine for a second, instead of hard coding that, instead there is a component to dynamically render that from a simple JSON configuration. So the JSON says that. It just says, okay, the first component in the list is a hero with these props. The next one is your quote call out, your product recommender with these props, et cetera. And so now imagine that JSON came over an API, just a list describing components and props, and then you installed on your website instead of, you know, hand coding that configuration, that ordering of components and props, you instead installed a simple component, like a React component that can ingest that JSON. You tag your components by name. So you say, this one's the hero component, this one's the product component. And it can just loop over that JSON and say, cool, put the hero here with these props, the columns here with these props. Now, it gets more nuanced than that. If you want to build that yourself, which we learned the hard way, you know, you have to worry about recursion. You've got columns that have buttons inside, and the button could have a child of this type and not that type. But that's like the system that we built out, the layer on top of it. But under the hood, it just ingests JSON that describes the UI and renders it using the combination of your components. And the way we make these SDKs for all frameworks, it's its own separate open source project. There's layers of challenges that we had to solve to make this work, but that's the really quick gist.
And so like that data, like the structure of the site in that regard, is that coming from a database specifically, or is it like being saved to like files or something? It's just coming from a, yeah, like database. Yeah.
Great question. Yeah, it's stored in a database because the idea, the goal here is that you have an end-to-end workflow where marketing team just goes in and makes a new variation of the homepage or a brand new landing page on some new URL. So they just click some buttons, drag and drop the components around, hit publish. It's saved in the database and it's live on your site as immediately as your site can update content. If it's server rendered, it's immediate. If it's static generated, it's on the next builds, you know, triggered by webhook or whatever.
Nice. Yeah, I always wondered, there's like a gap between, you know, building fully custom sites and building CMS-based sites where it's like what's saved in the database, right? You know, on a WordPress site, there's so many things that are saved into a database that aren't, you know, saved into a database when you're working in a fully just custom site. Okay, so builder.io, we got the picture.
Hold on. I have some questions here. Like, I want to make sure everybody understands it. So somebody signs up for builder.io, you hook it up to your own components that you have, and then your marketing folk can go in and drag and drop and it basically compose a page out of the library of components that you have. But you, the developer, you're writing 100% of the code in React or whatever framework you end up trying to use at the end of the day. That's right?
That's correct. And to clarify one thing too, you're not making a net new website or anything. Like, we don't host anything. You actually will generally, let's say you have a Next.js site, you'll make a new route on your Next.js site called like, you know, ..page.js to say catch all page. And in that, you make the simplest Next.js page ever that just says get stack props, call the builder API. And then we have the component that you pass that results from the API call to render your stuff. So you're working it into what you got. You're not like producing some new thing hosted like a Squarespace or something like that.
Oh, okay. Cool. And yeah. And this solves the problem of you generally have your app, but then you give the marketing folks their own website because you don't want to have to deal with them or to fuss with them or anything like that. You just go do your own website over there. We're building the app here, right? That solves that?
Essentially, yeah. And in some cases, so that's a common one. So that's just like builder stack. We have the heavy React app and we have the marketing site. Marketing owns the whole marketing site, mostly made from scratch. And that's one missing nuance here is you don't have to have components for everything. Some people, like, I'm trying to think of which customer, like Vistaprint, chooses like everything must be composed out of their React components. There's a design system. They want to stick to it, you know, tight guide rails. They don't want marketing going crazy. Mm-hmm. Other customers like Everlane or I almost named a customer I'm not allowed to. Some of our bigger customers are not allowed to use their names and logos. But anyway, a lot of customers will actually allow the marketing team to just actually create whatever they want. So you could look at it as compose my components, or you can look at it as full quote unquote no code that you can mix in code. So you can create anything you'd make on any other kind of site or page builder, like a Squarespace, Wix, or Webflow, totally from scratch and builder. Literally a kind of Figma-like UI. Just design it from scratch in Figma. But just drop in your components inside of that too. So in Builder's docs, it's basically made from scratch, but we needed a component to show nice code snippets and to show some other kind of dynamic data. So you just drop that in where you need it. And so in the case of that, you can find, you know, some websites, let's take Everlane. Their first use case is marketing just had to make more landing pages within their site without a developer backlog per new page. And so they hooked up Builder to make new landing pages. But then they're like, well, the homepage, can we just drag and drop that too? And it's like, yes, you remove the hard-coded content, you add that Builder component in for the homepage between the header and footer, ta-da, you've got a homepage that's visually editable. And they'll work that across pages. So there's many sites out there where like 80% of the website is controlled by Builder. And in this format, developers just make components and move on with their day. Mm-hmm. The marketing team composes them into whatever configuration they desire. You have hybrids where some pages are pretty hard-coded and maybe a section or two is editable in Builder. And some other full pages are Builder editable. And you can even have the extreme or kind of more code-heavy situations like you mentioned, Wes, which is you have an entire application that's meant to be all code. Inside of Builder, we have little call-outs like when you onboard, you know, there's certain screens on the onboarding that's like, we don't want to push new code to change the screen. This one's visually editable. This one, we're just going to drag, drop, change anytime. But a lot of the other stuff, like the drag and drop editor, that's not made in Builder. We could, but it's like, why? This should be in code. But composition that's content marketing-y, that should be outside of your code. So you don't have to push code for new marketing content. That's the
okay.
Idea.
And one other thing I'm curious about is, I think back to the WordPress days, you see something on the website and the client would say, how do I edit that? And you say, well, you go to the edit page and they would say, which input is that? And it's like, well, it's one of these 50 inputs that I pre-selected as options. So like, are we in a space now where you can edit the content in the component of what it looks like? I'm assuming yes, because it's a visual builder, right?
Yes. So this is really cool. The workflow is really seamless. And you're right. This was one of the big headless CMS challenges we had at ShopStyle that we built this thing to solve is exactly that. Whether it's WordPress or headless CMS, it is always like, what field do I edit? Which configuration? What model type is this? Because headless CMS is a model. So is this the blog article model or the blog page model? It's like, I don't know. So with Builder, one thing that's cool, because our little component controls the rendering, we add a little attribute in there that we added a Chrome extension that can read. So you can trigger a Chrome extension and it'll show you what you can edit in Builder on the page. And you just hit edit and it pops it open. And it's like, oh yeah, this is the hero component. Just click the hero component, change the props, hit publish, and it's updated. So it's definitely like, I want to edit this. You just click and edit it. It's about as visual as you'd imagine. And it's about as intuitive as you'd imagine. There's still rough edges that can happen in this situation, but it's quite a nicer workflow than probably what most are used to.
Yeah, and if you're out there and you're wondering exactly what this looks like, considering it is so visual, we have a link in the show notes for the demo, builder.io/demo. You can pop this thing open and just, honestly, one of the best things that we did this morning was just click around and click through it and try to see what you can make with it or see what you can do with it, adding blocks and whatever. It does feel very Figma-like in terms of you have your components over on the side. You can pick and choose, drag and where to drop them and everything like that. I got to ask about like the building of this tool. What is this tool built in specifically?
Yeah, great question. So it's a React app. For state management, we use something called MobX State Tree, which is built on MobX. I'm going to stop and not go on a huge rant about this. MobX State Management is freaking fantastic. And people do not realize, especially when you have like full applications, like heavy duty drag and drop or things that need back and forward state, how nice the style of state management that frameworks like SolidJS use, Quick uses, Vue has used for a while. AngularJS arguably used, just implemented it in a very poor performing way. It is quite nice. And so that's the two really, really big pieces. The rest is more from scratch than you might think. A lot of people, I didn't realize, kind of assume, oh, you're using a framework for the drag and drop. It's like, oh, this is so bespoke. We just had to build that from scratch. And just about everything is from scratch besides React MobX. And we use Material UI for buttons and stuff, which is great.
Yeah, right. Nobody likes doing the inputs. You can build all the complex drag and drop stuff in the world. And then you get to inputs. You're like, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I don't know about that.
Yes, yeah, right.
And there's like you guys have an adapter to design in Figma and convert it to HTML. What's that about?
That's a really good question. And that kind of touches on something I briefly touched on a minute ago, which is you kind of realize when building a system like this, there's some big missing pieces to get to the end result. So one big challenge we found, and this will seem like a tangent, but it will answer your question, I promise. I think it's helpful context. One big missing piece we found is like, okay, we need to make these what we call SDKs to be able to install to a React, Vue, Svelte, Quick, Solid, whatever website, and register components, dynamically render components. We also have built-in components. We have an image component, columns component, button, all this stuff. You could choose to use the built-ins. They're kind of like primitives, or your own custom components only. That's up to you. But it's most powerful when you use everything out of the box. To build that for all of these frameworks, so to rinse and repeat all of these different components for every single framework out there is way too much than, I mean, just last year, we were only a team of like 20. We're more than double that now. But at that time, that was just impossible to support all these frameworks without a huge effort, especially keep it all up to date. So one of the first things we did is we realized, well, Builder under the hood maybe does more than you might think. The reason we refer to it as a visual programming language is it is actually capable of doing anything you can actually do in React. So you can have components that dynamically fetch data from an external data source and render out things dynamically. You can create your own components that have child components that are made in Builder. So you can make a reusable component with inputs that dynamically binds. You can create effectively anything you can make in React, but fully visually, including imperative logic. You can say, click this button, the state changes, which triggers a UI to update and an animation to fly. It gets very, very bespoke if you so want it to be. And in doing that, we realized we had to make a data format that is a lot like an intermediate representation in compiler architectures. So like the LLVM compiler can transform, you know, Rust and C and Swift and all these languages to a format that then can turn into all of the different sort of like assembly, like lower level code that will become optimized for all the different machine architectures. In Builder, we needed an agnostic system for defining components. Again, simple compositions of your components or super intricate, super dynamic, super interactive things made from scratch visually that renders perfectly and consistently to React, Vue, Svelte, Quick, etc. I mean, everything. And so in doing that, we were kind of like, huh, another challenge we have is to make these SDKs, which we similarly need a simple way to define how to make components, and we can output code to all these different frameworks. And that is this intermediate representation, this JSON that just describes a div should go here with a hero there, and they should have a binding that connects this to that, and an event handler that triggers this binding to change or whatever. And so we made a project called Mitosis. It allows you to write a component in one way, originally JSON, because that's the data format Builder uses, but we later added the JSX syntax, so it's easy to write as a human. And then that can output code to Vue, Svelte, Quick, React, etc. So you can solve this problem of like, I want to make a material library, but I want it to support Svelte and Solid and Quick. Well, you could just write it in this project Mitosis. It parses JSX to JSON and then outputs to all these languages. When you have that, you realize, well, Builder has this GUI that outputs that, and this GUI can import from things like Figma because that's an obvious thing. You make a design, you pull it into Builder, you publish it on your site. It's a great workflow. Well, what if we just connect, you know, one cable to the next thing and say, okay, import from Figma, output to your framework. We've now created all these pieces. Apologies if that's the one thing that I think people will comment on is confusing of what I've said so far, but that's the gist of it.
It's amazing because it is like low code tools, no code tools, but also for the developer. It's like no code tools for developers. And that's got to feel like a really powerful thing. You know, one thing I think is like really fascinating is trying to dive into like the interface of building tools like this. So when you select something, it has blue boxes and margin dimensions and padding dimensions and dotted lines and here and there. Is at the end of the day, is that just divs all the way down, essentially? These interactive elements that you're building in a UI for this type of project, are those just divs and are you using anything fun there?
Yes. No, you're right. It's divs all the way down. I wish there were like common abstractions for these types of things. And maybe one day there will be, or like we make a lot of open source. Our core platform and editor are not open source, but you know, you talked about Quick and PartyTown and other things, I'm sure on other episodes of your podcast. But yeah, there really are no common abstractions. It is divs all the way down, but use something like React and MobX, or we'll probably move to Quick because we are feeling some of the performance challenges of the React app taking a minute to load. And we know we can solve that now, but migrating is a whole thing. So we'll figure that out when the time is right. But But yeah, React and MobX plus divs all the way down works surprisingly effectively.
Yeah, it was funny because when I was building my own like isolation design tool.
Cool.
For Svelte Kit. And it was kind of like Figma meets Storybook in a way where I've since put a pause on it because history, which is like kind of what I was basing it off of, has come out for Svelte Kit. So it's almost like I don't need it anymore. But when I was diving into a lot of these tools that have frames and they have canvases and whatever, I was shocked to see it's just divs all the way down. You click on a thing and you make some divs and you change the color. So like, oh, it really opened up the possibility. So the first thing I did when I clicked on this was went right to the divs and saw like how you're doing the, because it was some of the things that are so great in this, for those of you that might not know, that you have, when you have design tools and you put a box, you don't just have a box with, you could have a box with padding and margin and whatever. And those are illustrated when you select that box or hold option. And in the web, you don't really get a lot of those tools just by clicking around. So in Builder, you click on something, you hover over something, you're getting that spacing, you're getting those margins, that padding. And I think those are the types of web tools that we're truly missing in building interfaces right now with code, and something that I'm so impressed by with this tool in general. What about like the resizing of panes and stuff like that? I've done a fair amount of that myself, where you click and drag to resize a container. What's the process for making something like that?
That's a great question. And that probably will explain one nuance I wanted to point out about divs all the way down is there's really two layers here. So there is an iframe that displays the end results, and that is hooked up to your live website. So if you're everlane.com, you've got everlane.com in an iframe. And then you have what we call the overlays. You essentially have a div overlaid on top of the iframe that has all of these cool little things that show you the margins, padding, spacing, and they give you those little interactive bits like little bubbles, little drag handles to drag to resize. What's interesting is it is a big facade in a sense. In fact, we are always guessing at all times because we can't see inside the iframe. So we have to guess at where the position of something is. And occasionally we guess wrong. It's extremely rare. I found we had one very edge case just the other day where we guessed wrong. But we are guessing at where everything is. We just guess so accurately that it looks perfectly illustrated on top of the box and this and that. But what happens when you grab, let's say you want to edit the margin distance and you grab the little bubble and drag to edit, what's happening is you start, you know, moving your mouse up, and we track the mouse movement. So we're like, okay, you've moved it 10 pixels up over the course of a couple, you know, a second or so. What we do is we then message down to the iframe that dragging your mouse 10 pixels up means adding an additional 10 pixels of margin to this div or whatever it is. And we have a really lightweight kind of message bus going to the iframe to say, make little patches. So, hey, iframe, add margin top was 10, now make it 20. But we do this in real time. So it's really like margin top is 12, 14, 16, 18, whatever. And then we update the overlay optimistically. We're like, okay, the div should be here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then the div moves there, and it generally is perfectly in sync. And we do an additional check after you make the movements to say, did the div actually land there? We can do git bounding client rect. And under some rare circumstances, it couldn't land there because let's say you're dragging the height, but it actually had a max height. It's actually going to not be able to go past a certain point. So that's when we actually go, oh, wait, it stopped. And we'll usually catch that before the user notices any sort of glitch in behavior at all.
Wow, that's cool.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's really cool.
I can't imagine building something like, I'm just like in awe of building something like this. Cause like I one day woke up and I said, I'm going to implement drag and drop in vanilla JavaScript. And that was a hard day. That was a hard day. And that was a very ugly drag and drop solution. And imagine something like this is 1,000 times more complicated and intricate and whatnot. And it's not even being rendered in the same origin as the UI overlaying on top of it. You know, like I can't even get my divs to line up, let alone something on the entire website.
And you can't do anything synchronously. That's the other ugly part. The message passing must be asynchronous. So you can't know synchronously what's the location or position or even the state of many things. I'll give you a secret though. I bought the builder.io domain in 2013. I've made about 5 versions of this before the current one you see in production now. So I got a lot of mistakes out on versions like 1 through 4. Like many things I knew, like, okay, there's a wrong way and a right way. The last hard one though, it was on this one that I realized that you needed to have the rendering and the overlays in different frames. So that was the remaining big ugly thing that I had to figure out on the final production version. But beyond that, most of the original drag and drop mistakes were made prior, and how I knew which tools would work well for this.
Is there any like browser gremlins that you've hit doing this type of stuff? I'm sure. Do you have any stories you could share with us?
That's a good question. You know what's funny is we've hit a lot more browser gremlins when building things like Quick and Party Town, as weird as that sounds. Party Town really? In particular. Yeah, Party Town is browser gremlin city. Builder, the interface, mostly lives as an abstraction layer on top. But I will say there are a few things. Like, you forget that... Actually, here's the ugliest thing that's somewhat browser-related, but more just how people use browsers. When you're building an interface that must live within anybody's website... And their website may not, you know, do what many people do is, you know, asterisk, you know, all elements, box sizing, border box, like basic stuff like
oh,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's where you're like, you make this nice drag and drop system and people start using it on another website and go, this is really unintuitive. And it's like, oh yeah, because if you're not using border box, the behavior of padding and box positioning is really funky. And so you start adding some little CSS resets, be able to scope it to your stuff and not affect their stuff. So the compatibility between the expectations that our system has, or more like the intuition of people using a drag and drop editor, combined with anybody's website that's using who knows what, that was where all the crazy stuff happened. But these days, it's not a challenge. We found that there was a common set of ugly things that are easy to work around. I wouldn't say that 2 years ago. 2 years ago, I'd say it's a hair on fire, huge, monstrous issue. But today, we're like, okay, we're on the other side.
That's good.
Wait, do you have any drag and drop pro tips for like people who like maybe they're new to drag and drop? They might not be prepared for what's in store. Anything that you could have to save people a lot of time?
Yes. I forget what the proper definition of this is. But like my big one is like use a full featured reactivity system. So like if you ever watch Ryan Carniato talk about how reactivity works in Solid.js, you do not want to use Redux for a drag and drop system. Just don't. Don't use immutability. Don't do that whole like, I love functional programming. Don't use it for drag and drop systems. What works really well in my experience is MobX state tree, which is a bit like if you're familiar with Immr, which is more popular, but more simple, where... You need immutability in one aspect because every drag and drop system needs an undo redo because you're going to mess something up and you got to go back and forth quickly. So you need immutability for that. Yet when it comes to, in particular, performance, like, you know how I mentioned when you drag the margin top, it updates the div to change margin top. We used to do this in a Redux style flow where you have the entire tree of JSON representing the full composition. And we would update that tree and send it down to the iframe and re-render the whole tree. If you're doing that for every pixel of movement, that is horrifically slow. Mm-hmm. You have to do a mutation. You got to do a little patch to say, no, don't reflow everything. Just move this div 10 pixels. Anything else is going to give you performance problems. But when you're making the UI, like this, dragging this thing, the data in a system like this, where you have a hierarchy of elements and everything, everything you'll want to use references as much as possible. Like I'm dragging this element, update this element. I don't want to be looking and scanning through a tree to find the right element or changing the top level reference in a Redux style way. What you want to do is what MobX state tree is so good at providing, which is you mutate data, you can listen to granular changes to data and react in the UI or sending a message to the iframe in a granular little tiny piece by tiny piece way. But you can observe the entire tree and make copies of the tree or patches to the tree as it changes. So that becomes your history. You could fast forward and rewind. But in real time, you're not having to recompute big chunks of the tree just to render an update because a pixel changed. You need to do that piece granularly. And I've never seen a solution as good as MobX state tree, which is not popular. I don't even think it's super well maintained these days, but it's quite capable. And Michelle Westrate is incredible at what he's doing.
Cool. Like to kind of parlay off of that, does like FPS become like a major concern when you're working in this stuff, given performance and, you know, you're dragging and dropping things? So that's something that you guys are constantly evaluating?
Yeah, exactly. And we do it mostly, I wish I could say we did it in a more structured way, like using proper FPS tooling, but really we just have a gut feel on, is it janky? Is it not janky? And anytime it's janky, you got to remove the jank. And that's where the reactivity really comes in. I realize I probably didn't properly answer why the reactivity matters. It's largely just because when you're dragging, like, let me give a really quick example. And this relates to frames per second as well. A really easy way to make a dragging overlay is just to track the cursor position and have a reactive binding of this box is always the cursor top and left. So as cursor moves, you change a piece of state, cursor top and left is here and here. And now everything on the screen is relational to that top and left value. And just anything that must update, updates automatically. It's not listening to events, it's just listening to the change in state little piece by little piece. And the little piece is the important part for FPS, which is you don't want the whole tree to reflow. You don't want to manually rig up these type of redux situations where you're like, okay, if this selector changes, update this component. You want it to be as core, or as fine-grained, as like Ryan Carniato would say, as possible, so that if you're getting low FPS, that means you're too coarse-grained. You need to get finer and finer. What's updating, what must render, and nothing else should change, move, or execute, ideally.
Nice. Yeah, that's it feels like a big concern. So yeah, glad to hear that. Those are some nice sick tips.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Is there like dev tools for that type of thing? Like I remember back when I learned Redux, it was so cool that you could just look at every single change that had happened, and just it's just viewable. And that was like the moment it really clicked for me. In that, like, I can see I clicked this and I clicked that and I changed the page and I dragged this and dropped that, and then you can go back and if you really wanted to, you could change one of those values and it would ripple through the set of changes. Do you have similar tools for that with MobX?
Yeah, similar. I would say not as well maintained or up to date. I really do think that the project had a lot of evolution and it kind of plateaued at a certain point, but there is, and it follows the same pattern of like, there are actions. So like you said, with Redux 2, you could trace the actions, like X happened, then Y, then Z, not like this huge tree of function calls that you're just like, what was the thing that triggered the thing? All of that exists almost the same. They took essentially MobX's structure of like granular reactivity and just said, how do we get as much Redux-like feel out of this as possible? And that's what the state tree became.
And do you ever use that state tree to debug? Like a customer says it's glitching out, they'll email you and you say, oh well, are you able to like go and see when it glitched out, how they did that?
Yes. Yeah, we actually use a combination of we also use full story for better or for worse, like a screen recorder. And so we can actually replay people's sessions completely.
Yeah.
And it has a performance impact and that drives me crazy. But I remember this was a couple years ago now, but one time somebody sent me a message and it was super urgent. It was like, Builder automatically published a page that was not supposed to be live yet. And I was like, wow, that's really odd. That'd be a really strange bug, just the way the data flows for that to just magically happen. And they were like panicked and they're like, this is a huge problem. And if there was to keep happening, this would be, you know, very concerning. And so I went to Full Story and I opened up their session and I watched them drag their cursor over to the publish button, hit the publish button, and then move about their day. And I took a QuickTime recording and I said to them, I was like, you hit the publish button. I have a recording of it. And they're like, oh, yes. But we also, the other thing that we do is if you're like a builder admin, if you're authenticated with special level permissions, we actually put the state tree into the global scope. So like window.builder becomes the state tree and we could just debug in there and you can start running commands and methods and stuff and looking at the data. And that's a much cleaner way to deal with the data than like the raw data in the database, which gets compressed and kind of modified and stuff. And that helps a lot.
Yeah. Wow. Cool.
Man. Do you guys have to get into like wild SVG stuff at all with this?
No, but there's an asterisk on that, which is today we don't, but soon we might. And the reason why is we're doing some interesting exploration of the one challenge we find UX-wise with a tool like this is responsive design is still wildly unintuitive to people who have not had a background working with it. Like basically anybody who's not a developer, a front-end developer. So you throw a marketer at a drag and drop tool that's Flexbox based or defaults to Flexbox based and say, hey, make this page you want where you've got like buttons on the left, buttons on the right. You know, it's all kind of needs to be thought of in terms of flex rows, columns, grids, you know, something responsive. And it could be really confusing. It's like, I just want this button over there. But when I drag it, it kind of snaps here or snaps there. And it's like, yeah, that's the flow of the page. And so we're experimenting with a much more Figma-like editing mode that's absolute position while you're editing And then we're looking at using, and I hesitate to say this because I am the last person to think that AI will solve X problem.
Yeah.
But I actually think we're in a state where we're messing around with a potential solution to use machine learning to solve the problem of design like Figma, but automatically convert it to a responsive format. And I think we have it whittled down to a solvable piece. We'll find out. But once we do that, I know what people are going to want. They're going to want to treat Builder like a full-on design tool, like mm-hmm. SVG, all the elements, and or be able to import from Figma. Right now, for our Figma import, we require you to use their auto layout system, which means like rasterizing SVGs or converting them to a single like SVG image and converting everything to effectively flexbox, you know, rows and columns. But people, what they really want is just take my design and make it a page, you know, a full-on, nicely laid out divs, etc. And so if we solve the absolute to flex conversion problem, which I think a little bit of machine learning and sometimes some prompting in the UIs, ask the user for a choice or an input so that we can make a decision. And then we can definitely, if we can then pull in sort of SVGs and be able to deal with that and make that optimized, then maybe theoretically you can have that holy grail of just design becomes code that like you might have seen in Builder. You can spit out anything made or imported into Builder as React, Vue, Svelte, Quick, etc. It's surprisingly idiomatic and keeps getting cleaner, that code output. Or you just hit a button and it publishes to your live site and it's proper ADA, SEO, optimized, etc. code. That's our kind of holy grail and we're hoping we get there. We're making progress each day.
Where does Quick fit into all of this as well?
So that's definitely the right question. Let me give you the background on that. What we are, and I can explain where PartyTown comes in at this point too, because it's sure. the next step yeah. as well.
Also, maybe explain real quick what PartyTown is when you hit that.
Yes. Okay. I'll do that. Actually, yeah, I think the backstory will explain everything. So here's what happened. We made this visual editor and we were so proud. You can make anything as visual editor, drag and drop to make rich, dynamic, amazing, or just simple compositions with your awesome components. You can do awesome stuff, right? And it's very intuitive, drag and droppy. But we were really proud that what renders on your website is much more performant than you're going to be expecting. You're going to expect like, oh, I've seen Dreamweaver. I've seen Microsoft Live Page or whatever, Front Page, whatever it's called. And those things are notorious. Like GUI tools that generate any type of code are notorious for generating sloppy, ugly, poor performing, buggy, problematic code. So the first thing we found when people started seeing Builder is they're like, I don't want to touch that. Drag and drop, not on my site. I've seen what these things are like, and I don't want that. And so we were like, no, you don't understand. Like, we optimize the heck out of it. I wrote this huge blog post of the insane amount of optimizations we do. Like, when you upload an image, how we break it into source set sizes, all this stuff, how we actually load it into Puppeteer, and we look at the exact sizes it renders at all screen sizes and add browser hints accordingly. It's insane the work we do on the performance side. Now, we started showcasing that and saying, this is definitely the most performance experience you'll get. Like drag and drop publish and the end result that displays to your end users, you'll not get anything more performant. Yet people would hook it up to their gigantic React apps that already get like 7 out of 100 on Google PageSpeed Insights. And they add Builder and it'll still be 7 out of 100. And they'll be like, why page not fast? If Builder fast, why is the page not fast? Mm-hmm. And we're like, oh, well, that's because your mega React app is still loading like 5 megabytes of JavaScript. Whether you added Builder to this page or not, we can't. Performance is a process of removing things, not adding things. Adding Builder can generally not make something faster. You have to remove things that load or execute to make the site faster. So more and more people start hooking up Builder to websites that got a range of performance, but many poor performing, especially because a lot of customers are larger companies. And larger companies, you get more of a death by 1,000 cuts. You have a lot of code, a lot of developers. Your page speed times really start to suffer. And so people would start going, oh, you know, XYZ websites use Builder. And they don't even understand Builder's not like Wix. It adds to what you have. It doesn't build and construct the whole website for you. And so they're like, why are these example websites not fast if you keep saying what Builder produces is so fast? We started by responding with, well, these sites are just slow and you can't make it faster by adding Builder. And that didn't go well. People like, you know, anywhere from insulted to like, you know, that doesn't help me. So we're like, well, what is making these websites slow? And in fact, like why does the Builder website only get like 60 out of 100 on Google's PageSpeed Insights for mobile? And so we already had this technology that could take any kind of visual composition of stuff and output it to React or Vue or anything. And I was like, well, let's figure out why our website's not as fast as it could be. And so I was like, well, let me try outputting. I mean, I optimized every single thing that Builder produces to an insane degree, but I could not get past this kind of 60, 62 mark. And so I was like, well, let me try different frameworks entirely. Let me output this to Vue and SolidJS and Svelte and all this stuff. And I could get it to like 65. And I was losing my mind. And eventually I was like trying to just hack and slash my way towards what will make this site fast. I tried deleting huge areas of the DOM. I tried just deleting all the images. I was just deleting anything to see where do I get it fast again. Because we all know Hello World is fast. You get 100 out of 100 with a text results.
We just talked about like all those examples of the websites being like, here's 100 page speed. Oh, yeah. And then it's like nothing but text. Okay, cool.
Exactly. Yeah. That part's easy. So it's like, where's the big bottleneck coming in? And the test that worked, I mean, I was writing around 62 and I was just trying to get to like 65. And I just said, well, let's do this. Let's just delete all the script tags, like the React, everything. And I pushed that up and that just rocketed to 100. And it was like perfect performing website. And I was like, wait a second. And I add the scripts back. And I try every framework and every framework's perfect without JavaScript and got really ugly once you add the JavaScript back. And again, this was just the framework and the code to render out the components. And what became clear as I dove into it further was this makes sense. The way, and I know you have a separate episode on Quick, so some might be redundant, but it makes perfect sense that you generate HTML for a page, but then you got to download all the JavaScript that generated that in the first place. You got to parse, execute, and bind all of those events and components and all that stuff, and then the page is usable. That process of the amount of code you download and execute is actually pretty significant. It's blocking the main thread the entire time. And that page is not loaded and ready until a lot of stuff runs. And that's what kind of stuck in my head of like, we got to get rid of all this JavaScript. And we're building applications more and more like JavaScript first. Let's build JavaScript components and then back into HTML as opposed to the old way, as you know, let's send HTML from the server and sprinkle in JavaScript as we need, which huge caveat, I don't believe in sprinkle in JavaScript. That works until it doesn't. And when it doesn't, it becomes a huge problem. So how do you solve this? We started being like, well, how about we make this compiler that generates, you know, React or Vue or whatever code, either ahead of time or at runtime. Let's make it so that we can just generate pure HTML and let's just generate little tidbits of JavaScript only as needed. And this was working and I was able to get our site to be this kind of pure HTML, almost old school PHP-esque mode. And I was getting good performance scores, but it was really hard to think about, well, how would you add your custom components in this format? Would you use web components? Well, web components are still very JavaScript heavy. It loads and renders via the browser, JavaScript main thread. Again, we'd be reintroducing the same problems again. And then I meet Mishko, who's like, this is back when he was still working at Google or had just left, and was like, hey, I've got this way to load websites without any JavaScript needing to execute. And so basically you send HTML and the page is loaded. And I was like, that is what I need so badly. That's what all these websites need. That's what all these customers and people looking at Builder who want to have best performance is what we all need. And so that's where we were like, hey, we have this challenge of people just want to drag drop and have a super optimized site out of that. We have an even larger problem. If people just want fast sites in general, and they're asking us how to solve it because they see Builder controlling 80% of that page, and they think, well, 80% being generated by Builder must mean Builder is the biggest kind of impacting of the score. And it's like, no, it's not. It's the invisible stuff that is. But they need a solution. We had no solution. It was like, what, go rebuild your website in PHP? That's not going to be a very good recommendation. So that's where we're like, you know what, we need this quick project for our site. We need it for our customers. And we think the world needs it really badly because this JavaScript runtime problem has gotten out of hand. The DX of components and React style DX is incredible, but the way it loads, especially if you are what we call like a conversion driven website, like e-commerce, you just need a page to load fast and the button's got to work. And that makes a huge difference on how much money you make on that page or not. People will bounce if it's slow, and websites are pretty slow these days. And so that's what led us to being like, we need to invest in this and make sure this gets to production, sees the light of day.
Wow.
Interesting. Okay, good. Because I always understood that. It's sometimes you see companies pouring so much resources into open source framework, and then it's just like, how does that connect? Like, I understand maybe if you're using it and you need it and stuff like that, and that makes sense.
that's a very common thing people don't know about Builder when they see it at surface levels. How do these things connect? So I can relate. And I forgot, just so you know, where Party Town fits as well. I could explain that briefly because even before Mishko joined, we were like, had this whole hypothesis of these two pieces connected could be fantastic and each one independently is so useful. Like, let's invest in this. But we first wanted to prove it out. So we hooked up quick to Builder's homepage and it worked fantastic. All the interactivity with wildly better performance than we can achieve anywhere else. Awesome. Except one big thing. The other thing I deleted to make the page fast was all the third-party scripts. and so we were like, okay, we're going to go all in on this quick thing. But we actually were stuck. We're like, if you cannot solve the fact that third-party scripts are going to come in and totally clobber the performance benefits of removing all of your first-party runtime JavaScript, then there's no point to this at all. It's a futile effort. And we just know from experience, I know from all my past experience, you don't just ask the marketing team to remove all the third-party JavaScript. It just doesn't happen. And so that's where we kind of obsessed over, okay, we know for a fact your website can have insanely good performance if you eliminate virtually all JavaScript running on the main thread. So if you can do that for your code via the framework, that's great. But the code you don't control, like Google Analytics and the 50 other things you might be using, we need that code to run somewhere else. It's either got to run on a server, at the edge. We explored all this stuff. But we eventually landed on, we need to push that code to a web worker. And Adam, who created Ionic and works on Quick now and everything. He also created Stencil. Anyway, he does a bunch of stuff. He kind of had the idea on how we could use a clever trick to be able to run all of this third-party code in a web worker, but still have limited but enough access to the main thread so that Google Analytics just runs. And many third-party scripts just run, and a few others were kind of making sure they get working now. And then you can finally have this pipe dream of websites that load crazy fast, whether they're written by developers or by non-developers. Like myself, 20 years ago before I could code, theoretically, I could have just used a tool like Figma to create whatever I wanted, whether it was just on my own or part of a much larger company building cool stuff connected to all kinds of cool components and data. And it just works and it's just fast and it's easy and intuitive and collaborative and fun and everybody's happy now. That's the goal.
Yeah, right. Everybody's happy is always the goal. When you're building a tool that's so drag and drop based, is there are challenges that come up around accessibility features in terms of like, how are people able to use this thing?
Yes. And so you can look at it from both sides, actually. So accessibility on using the drag and drop interface, absolutely. And that's something that it's kind of an ongoing thing to improve all of the time. And something you kind of need to be pretty intimately aware of, a lot more nuance to accessibility than you might need to be if you're just making a blog site or something. So that is a huge factor and something we're always having to sort of play with, test out, and refine all the time. The other aspect that you'll find comes up a lot is people are just drag and dropping. They don't think about semantic HTML, like this is a section versus an article versus a main versus a nav versus whatever, list items, you know, button versus, you know, anchor, et cetera. And so they're just dragging and dropping boxes. I'll put a box there, I'll put a box there, I'll put this component there. But the end result has to be as semantic. It has to be fast, SEO, ADA, everything needs to be great. And so that's where you kind of start finding, luckily, there is a number of tricks. The one thing that is nice is, for the most part, with a more modern drag and drop system like we offer, you want the people creating things to think semantically. And realistically, they actually, in many cases, prefer to think that way as well. They don't want to say, oh, I want a button, so I better drag a box, give it a background color and a click listener and some extra attributes to make clickable. They're like, no, I just want a button. Give me a button. So it's like, okay, you can make all the built-in primitives as well as like templates use the proper elements and proper semantic markup and ADA compliant everything because they like to think one abstraction level higher. So in that way, you get some benefits. But in some other ways, you need some more granular guidance. Like you really should use sections and a section should have an H2 and some additional content. And that's where we started taking inspiration from like VS Code or really any IDE and started dropping hints in the IDE like, hey, missing some sections. Yeah. So yeah. Think of like the yellow squiggly lines, but just kind of yellow outlines with warnings and suggestions, which works surprisingly well.
And man, if this conversation has done nothing else, it has taught me that my overly optimistic view of building a tool like this is just exactly that. there's so many little considerations in here that I don't think about at first. You're like, oh yeah, you could build a drag and drop based tool. And just hearing you talk about all of the things that you have to consider, it's pretty amazing.
Well, if it makes you feel better, I didn't know any of this stuff going in. It was all learned by trial and error.
there was no grand plan. Yeah.
I think it's best that way. If I knew everything I knew now, everybody says this, right? I would not go build another drag and drop editor. I think it would just be way too daunting. But when you do it naively, like, oh, I just need to do this little thing and solve this little thing at a time. Next thing you know, you learn a lot and look back and go, wow, that was a lot of work.
Yeah, right.
All right. Let's move on to some Supper Club questions. These are questions we ask everybody who jumps on. What computer, mouse, and keyboard are you using?
Oh, I have such a lame answer. I just have a plain MacBook Pro from probably like 2016, and that's it. I use the built-in keyboard and trackpad, and that's all. I'm really minimalistic in that way.
Wow. And is that just because do you travel a lot, or that's all you want? You just sit down at the laptop and go?
So it came from when I used to work at an office, and it drove me crazy that you'd have your awesome setup at your desk with your multiple monitors and all this stuff. And once you unplug the monitors, everything is all jacked up. Your windows aren't laid out right anymore and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I got so used to being in and out of meetings that I was just like, I need to have one way of working, and this is my way. Now that we're in, we're a fully remote company builder, so people all around the world, ever since the pandemic, so I work from home, I'm at home now. I eventually just kind of kept with that habit, and it is nice because I do travel a lot. I'm going to India tomorrow. We have a small team there, and so, yeah, it'll be nice. I'm just using my laptop there just like I am here, and that does happen a lot. So I guess travel's the short answer, and that was the longer answer.
Beautiful.
Sick. What about your terminal?
I just use Visual Studio Code's built-in terminal for the most part, except when I need to do something fancy. I've used so many versions of terminal, but for some reason, I just go back to the Mac default terminal. But I use OhMyZeesh. So Zeesh everything after that, and probably an absurd amount of aliases. Maybe not absurd relative to others, but yeah.
Yeah, I like aliases.
If you had to start coding from scratch, so someone comes to you and says, hey, I want to get into web development. What do you tell them to do, whether it's builder and services or a specific language or whatever?
Yeah, that's a great question. Obviously, you know, a little bit tailored to the individual, but my default recommendation would be what I did is ideally find something you want to make. It's probably a website. It's hopefully something simple like a website. It's not like AI crazy something, you know. And then learn the HTML, learn the CSS, learn the JavaScript, probably in that order. And as you may have heard before, and many people know, given JavaScript so universal, you could build mobile apps, websites, servers, whatever the heck. You could build your AI stuff in JavaScript too. Knowing that language is so versatile and universally useful, yet relatively approachable, I think, especially given that you can see what you're doing as you build things, right? So versus building backends, it's very hard to visualize what you're doing. You can build something HTML, CSS. You can add alert to the button. Then you can add a state change to the button. And you can kind of feel what you're doing until you get advanced and you know the intricacies of the language. And then you build a lot of stuff in the dark, but you kind of have your head wrapped around the tricky bits at that point.
Yeah. What's something that you're excited about in the future of these tools?
Really, it's two things. It's solving the workflow side. Like it's still insane to me how the whole design handoff workflow still works. And I'm really inspired by, honestly, the game industry is way ahead of the web and app industry in this regard.
Way ahead,
it's
yeah.
Wildly. It's insane. Like if you play, like I just got Dead Space remake just came out. Just alien spaceship, you know, zombie shooter. But like if you sit and look at the insane graphics of that game and imagine if a developer had to sit down and like type in every color by hand in every position, like margin top, it would never happen. It's just impossible. The expectations of the gaming industry are way beyond in some ways what we do for sites and apps. So the need to create visual tooling and better workflows was just a hard requirement. You had to have a designer actually go in and work with the game objects in a visual way, lay out the scenes completely visually, but unlike what we do today, it's completely attached to the actual code of the game object. It is not necessarily, it depends on the game engine, obviously. It's not necessarily like we do today where we have like mockups of our components and it's kind of pretend. It's like, no, you're actually designing with the C++ classes that represent these game objects. You can hit play and start playing at any time, test it out end to end. Every little detail, the connectivity between UI and code is so clean and seamless. And so that makes for a great workflow. Handoffs don't exist in certain areas of game development like they do in web and application development. And it's just freaking cool. Like, it really is cool. Like, that dream, I probably would have never learned to code if 20 years ago there just was a program to visually make sites and applications to the level of detail and intricacy I wanted, like, without these kind of barriers. And I want to see that become a reality.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Let's move into some sick picks. This is the section where we ask our guests to pick something that is sick. I don't know if you came prepared with a sick pick or not.
I did.
All right.
So there's, I don't know what happened recently. So I've always been obsessed with zombie, and I don't know why. Like, end of the world zombie stuff is just fascinating to me.
Yeah.
The Walking Dead was the greatest show of all time until like season six or something before it started really going off a cliff. I love so many sort of zombie movies and games. So for whatever reason, I realized late in the game how fun Resident Evil games are. And I've, in the last 2 weeks, I've played through 4 Resident Evil games. Like 2 and 3 and 7 and 8 were all fantastic. 2 and 3 are remakes and 7 and 8 are recent ones. I just got Dead Space. I'm playing through that. And as we all know, right now on HBO is The Last of Us, which is a freaking phenomenal show. I just watched episode 3 and was like blown away. I was like, this show is better than I expected, and already had pretty high expectations because of the game and HBO. So I guess it's not specific. If I had to pick one, Dead Space is pretty cool. I'm going through it now. But more broadly, zombie stuff is awesome, and I love it.
What Resident Evil game would you recommend? I've never played any of them, and that's always been on my radar. Yeah.
If you're feeling patient, so the greatest Resident Evil game of all time is Resident Evil 4, which came out like 15 years ago. But a remake is coming out on March 24th, and I'm like counting the days. So play that. I bet you it's going to be incredible.
Yeah, perfect. If it's the best one, remake, I'll take it. Yeah.
Yeah.
What about shameless plugs? What would you like to plug today?
I mean, it's probably obvious. So Builder.io, what we talked about, we call it a visual CMS. Try it out. If you've got a problem with workflows, or like marketing always needs stuff, and you're like, oh, I don't want to change a button color again, just hook up Builder and let them just make and test and do whatever they want without having to make you the step in the process. As an engineer personally, I hate feeling like I'm somebody else's pencil or paintbrush that they have to maneuver me to get something done. It's awful. Like, here's your components, go build stuff, make the guide rails, and move on. But as is probably obvious as well, Quick is in beta. We are, the thing is cool as heck, in my opinion. Obviously, I'm biased, and performs wildly well. So if people want to kick the tires on that, it's awesome. We're really racing to get to a V1, I hope, in the next couple months. So stay tuned for that. Party Town's in beta, and we are, that one's harder to get to a V1, but yes, we are making progress on it as well. And yeah, that's probably the things I definitely most shamelessly want to plug.
Sick.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, we didn't even get to talk about MaxMSP, which was something like that.
That was my first foray into visual programming, and it's actually significantly inspired Builder. I took a class on that in college, and so...
Me too.
It's in there. It's awesome.
Well, did you build anything cool with Max?
Oof, I thought my things were cool, but yeah, we had this really strange music course that taught us to build...
Yeah.
I don't know what you would call it, like almost like instruments, custom instruments or visual workflows for music. And I built some weird stuff, but I learned a lot about music, and I learned best by touching things and connecting pieces. So I learned a lot about how audio waves work because of that I would have never learned without something like it.
What school did you go to, by the way? Just
UC Berkeley. Did you go to the same one and take the same class?
No, different. I went to Michigan for music technology. And that was like, I had to take several semesters of MaxMSP. So I did a theremin that used my Apple's webcam. And I did like a projection that projected piano keys, and you could run through them and it would trigger the notes. Like,
oh, that's cool.
MaxMSP was like, people in my class made a table tennis game that generated electronic music and stuff. Man, it was just like the coolest stuff.
Was that what you got you into programming, or was that totally separate and related?
Yeah, I was doing like basic Flash stuff, but it's what got me into like more complex beyond HTML stuff. So
I love that. I just took this random experimental music something. It was the weirdest course ever, but it decided to teach you at MaxMSP, and that was just the coolest part. I just went nuts on that that program.
Yeah, wild interface to do all sorts of cool stuff. Well, thanks so much for coming on, Steve. It's been awesome. Love Builder. I love the look of it. It's a tool that so many of us have always wanted. So keep up the good fight on the visual tools. And I can't wait to try this out at least a little bit more official capacity.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you, guys. This was a blast.
All right. Thanks a lot. Peace.
Thanks, Steve. Peace. head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.